In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's Coolest Conversations time, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. And please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. My very special guest today is award-winning producer Bob Ezrin. His career has spanned some six decades, and he's worked with a host of greats, including Alice Cooper, Lou Reed, Pink Floyd, Kiss, Nils Lofgren, Dr. John, Rod Stewart, and Hanoi Rocks, among them. We'll speak with just a moment, but first we're going to give a listen to Under My Wheels from Alice Cooper. It's a 1971 single. It's one that Bob shares writing credit on with band members. And after that, I'll be back with Bob Ezrin, for your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
The telephone is ringing. You got me on the run. I'm driving in. You were under my wheels, honey. Why don't you let me be? 'Cause when you call me on the telephone, say, take me to a show. And then I say, honey, I just can't go. Oh, lady, say, I can't leave her home. Telephone is ringing. You got me on the run. I'm driving in.
Mighty Manfred here, and it's a big day for our Coolest Conversations in Little Steven's Underground Garage, because I have the honor of chatting with Bob Ezrin. His career as a record producer and songwriter stretched for over six decades, and he's best known for his work with Alice Cooper, Lou Reed, Aerosmith, Kiss, Pink Floyd, Deep Purple, Peter Gabriel, among many other greats. He's Canadian and a winner of a number of music awards, including three Juno Awards, which are like a Canadian equivalent of Grammys. Bob, how are you? Thanks for joining me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you. And I'm doing great. I'm happy to be working and traveling and talking to people like you. So let's go.
Let's go. So when you sold your soul to the devil with this whole rock music thing, do you think he realized how much mileage he was going to get out of you?
I had no idea. And I'm not sure I sold my soul to the devil, or whether I sort of I defeated the devil and went to heaven, because this has just been the most incredible ride. I wake up every day grateful and just thankful for all of the opportunities that I've had, for the amazing people I've been able to work with and be in the room with, you know, for those magical moments that I've witnessed firsthand and been able to participate in. It's just been fabulous. I you know, somebody said to me yesterday, that Tim Schmidt from the Eagles had told them that if his career had ended 30 years ago, he would still be grateful. And that's me, you know, like if my career had ended in 1979, I would still have been like unbelievably grateful for the rest of my life. But for some reason, I have not yet been found out, and people still allow me into those rooms, you know, to continue to make music. I can't think of anything, I can't think of a blessing higher.
Well, I mentioned you being Canadian, and my understanding is that you grew up in Toronto. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. I grew up in Toronto, and I'm, speaking of thankful, I mean, I'm thankful to have been born in that place at that time and into my family because, you know, my dad, though he ended up being a professor of medicine, my dad worked his way through university by playing bass in a big band. And my mom was a concert grade pianist who was too shy to play for large audiences. So we were the audience, and I used to sit under the piano and listen to her pound the Warsaw Concerto. And that gave me, I think that's what actually attracted me to heavy music, because that was like, for me, that was heavy metal. And my parents really believed in culture. I mean, I took piano lessons from a very early age. We all sang, we all learned to dance. We were sort of the Canadian Von Trapps, you know. And all of us started working in television when we were very young. My twin brothers got the first gig and they were five. And then I became the sort of go-to, you know, the one-line son that you put into sketch comedy. So I became that go-to kid, and I played the son of various actors and personalities and stuff on television when I was eight. And I fell in love.
Got you.
Fell in love with the studio there.
Okay. All right. You fell in love with being in a studio. So that wasn't such a huge jump to a recording studio, or?
No. Not only that, but I also got a tape recorder as a birthday gift when I was 12. So, you know, I'm 8 years old, 9 years old, and I'm doing television. And also my brothers and I ended up doing a lot of voiceover work. And we were the voices of Shreddies, which is like, you know, mini shredded wheat here. They call it Shreddies in Canada. So we were the voices of Shreddies. We would go into the studio and record the Shreddies theme song and stuff. So I've been around, you know, recording and the lights and the smells of studios and the people. And I just, you know, I felt like it was a natural segue. It didn't feel to me like that should stop.
Well, let me ask you. So you've got this sort of background that got you into studios, and you're doing voiceover stuff. So that's a recording studio, even, or studios that can do recording. And you've got this. So you mentioned the sort of picking up this, I love the heavier music from the piano. But what about specifically rock music? Were you listening? What were you listening to rock pop stuff as you were growing up, or?
Well, you know, Toronto was sort of in the sort of crossroads between U.S. Radio and British radio and television. So we got a lot of stuff. We got stuff from Buffalo, which had a lot of R&B and also had a lot of American pop music and the sort of nascent burgeoning rock music coming from the United States. But we also got the British invasion in a very big way. I mean, it came through because Canada and Britain were very much aligned in those days and stuff. So you were, you know, if you were living in Toronto at that time, you were surrounded by it with all media from radio to television to print. And it was hard to avoid. I was a folky, actually. I started playing guitar. Like, I studied piano from the age of six, but I couldn't take my piano to parties. It was tough. I tried, but it just didn't work.
You weren't going to be satisfied with a Vox Continental or a Farfisa?
No. And so... No. Yeah, so I got a guitar and I just started. I love the guitar and I started to play some of the stuff that I heard on the radio. But also, I really got into folk music in a very big way. So I was playing in folk clubs. My uncle, my father's brother, was part owner of a club called the Penny Farthing in Toronto, which was on Yorkville Avenue. Yorkville the Yorkville Village was the sort of Greenwich Village or Gaslight District of Canada. And it was, in fact, between those two, alongside of those two, rather, it was the third leg of the stool for you know, the folk circuit. Everybody played those three areas all the time. And on Yorkville, every other door was a club, like literally. Like literally, you walk down the street, there's a club, then there's, you know, somebody's house, and then there's a club. And so there were a million clubs, and the penny farthing, like my uncle let me play in the basement to audiences of one and a half or two people, you know, but I loved it. And but upstairs there were, you know, there were these artists coming through. There was this blind kid from South America with a dog called Jose Feliciano who played his first North American gig in that club. And I went up there and watched this guy. He was a virtuoso on guitar and just an amazing singer and you know, totally inspirational. And then there was this girl from Alberta called Joni Anderson, who, as you know, is Joni Mitchell, who was 19 years old and beyond gorgeous. I was 15 and so in love with her. In fact, I went to one of the Clive Davis dinners, you know, one time, and I was seated next to Joni. And I just said, when we were sort of reminiscing about the Toronto days and stuff, and I said, you know, I was truly in love with you. And she said, did you know I was pregnant? And I said, I would have raised the kid, Joni.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, I was going to ask you how old you were. So you were 15 when you were playing the penny farthing.
Yeah. And then the Beatles came along and that changed everything.
Okay. Yeah, that's it. And then, so what was your exposure to the Beatles? Typically here, it's the story I hear over and over again, you know, in the U.S. is the Ed Sullivan Show, right? That's sort of this thing. Even people I didn't expect that would be to have heard it, like Peter Buck from R.E.M. was like, no, I was like 5 years old and I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. How did you come in contact with the Beatles in terms of
it was radio.
Radio?
Yeah, it was radio. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't see the Ed Sullivan performance because at that time I just thought that this rock thing that everybody was talking about was sort of low rent in comparison to the headiness of folk music, you know, the sort of intellectual side of folk music and all that stuff. So I was snobby. And I was avoiding rock at the time. And then I think it was a combination of, it was not just the Beatles and Beach Boys, a combination of Good Vibrations and Penny Lane that were worms in my brain and completely rewired me, like instantly. And I just started realizing, wow, you know, you can paint pictures with this stuff. This is not just, you know, playing three chords and singing the truth. This is like creating entire cinematic soundscapes and moving people through, you know, complex storytelling. And that really appealed to me. So that changed me. And then from that moment on, I started to experiment with sounds and, you know, messing about with my little tape recorder, and in my uncle's house. My uncle, who co-owned the penny farthing, also had the largest private collection of jazz records in Canada, and he had all kinds of toys in his basement, you know, all kinds of different turntables and tape machines and stuff like that. So I was playing down there already. But once I heard those things...
You were making home recordings then of yourself?
Yeah, home recordings we actually found, I can't believe it, but I had a couple of friends from Buffalo. I don't even remember how we met, but we became buddies and the three of us decided to be a band. We'd be a band. And we must have been 13 or 14 years old at the time. They came up to Toronto and they came to my house and we had a song called You Lied. That I think I wrote, and so we recorded it, and I actually found the tape, which
which blew my mind. I couldn't believe that I had it, but I found the tape and I got it baked and transferred onto digital format. So I've got it. And when I want a dose of humility, I go back and listen to that.
I wouldn't sell your late teen angst short there. I'm sure, especially with a title like You Lied. I mean, is there a good snarl in there? I mean, she must have been lying pretty terribly.
There was a good snarl.
But okay, you're doing these home recordings. What is the moment that gets you actually into wanting to be working in a music studio?
Well, there were many moments, actually. You know, when I was taking piano lessons, we shifted to jazz for a short period, and I was taking lessons from a guy named Art Snyder, who had a recording studio. And in one room it was the piano where we were supposed to be working, but in the recording studio part, there was a Hammond B3. And cool. And Art used to, I would arrive for my lesson, and the first thing he'd do is send me downstairs to get him a salami and egg sandwich. And then when I come back up, you know, we'd play a few things. He'd realize that I hadn't done my homework, and then he'd send me into the other room and say, just go play the organ. Right. So I'd be playing a B3 in a studio and going, I like this. This is big. Yeah. I like this. So, you know, I got a dose there. I got a dose when we were doing our voiceovers. Because of my my sort of, you know, teenage residency on Yorkville, I ran into a folk artist named Beverly Glenn Copeland, who was extremely talented. And I thought she was so great, and I believed in her so much, that I scraped together, I think it was $120, and took her into Eastern Sound in Toronto to record some of the stuff that I'd heard. And maybe that was my first time on the other side of the glass where I just, you know, I was telling people what to do. I really liked it.
She was the first artist you produced then.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that would be correct. Yeah.
Well, who is Zach Richardson, and how did he help shape or further your career? Begin your career as a music producer. I mean, he's pretty integral to this, isn't he, or not?
No, he is. He's everything to this. So, without spending an hour, sort of setting this up, because it was a very complicated history. But I went from television to folk clubs, back to television. I was a writer, and I wanted to write movies. I just wanted to make things. I was a maker of stuff, right? And so I ended up on staff as the script editor on a musical review and a satirical review. They wanted rock music, and the music director of that show was Jack Richardson's partner, Alan McMillan, who just recently passed away and was one of the dearest and sweetest men in the entire world. Alan, he didn't feel that comfortable with rock, and I was the script editor. Like, I'm the guy getting the jokes, getting the comedy material, but on the side, Michael Cole, who became the greatest concert promoter in history, Michael Cole and I were co-managing, I'm making quotation marks in the air here, co-managing a band called Icarus. The lead singer was Eddie Schwartz, who ended up writing Hit Me With Your Best Shot and many other big hits. But Eddie, so we were co-managing this band, and Michael thought that meant booking them in clubs, and I thought that meant working on their songs.
Okay.
And we were both wrong. But anyway, so when the show wanted rock music, I said, well, I know this band. And like, I was secretly just trying to get them a gig. So we put Icarus into the show. And then Alan said, you know, well, you know these guys and everything. So, like, can you help with some of this music stuff? And I said, let me do it. I'll do it. Don't worry about it. And you just come and see what, you know, what I've done. And if you like it, we'll keep it. And if you don't, we'll change it. So I ended up, you know, being assistant musical director on the show and kind of responsible for the rock elements and stuff. And by the end of the show, he said, you know, my partner could use somebody like you. So I went for a meeting at Nimbus 9 Productions. Nimbus 9, excuse me, Nimbus 9 was a partnership of four ex-advertising executives, four ex-McCann Erickson guys. Jack Richardson being the president of the company and the sort of producer amongst the group. Jack had a band called The Guess Who. And at that time that I went to see him, they had a song called American Woman, which was number one in the world.
Yeah.
And at that moment, Jack was one of the most important producers in the world. Maybe, if, you know, maybe at that exact moment, the most important. So I went in to meet with him in his offices, and he said, "So you know, Alan says you're pretty talented and stuff. What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, I want to be a manager. I want to work with bands and people and help them with their songs and do all that, you know, and help them with like, you know, their performances and everything." He says, "You don't want to be a manager. You want to be a producer." And since I needed a gig really badly, I said, "Yes, sir, that's exactly what I want to do." So he hired me. God bless him. He hired me. And God bless Alan for bringing me in and for sponsoring me in a sense. And then he was, Jack was so generous with his knowledge. I was like voracious. I was like a Hoover. I was just sucking up info at like as fast a rate as anybody could stand, because I was like that annoying kid that asked questions every 30 seconds. And I had this notebook and I was just like writing down everything Jack was saying. But what was cool was he had me then go do pre-production on bands. Then he would take them in the studio and I would go with him. So for 6 months or so, I was doing that pre-production for bands that Jack was producing. I'd go into the studio with him. And then Shep Gordon, the manager of Alice Cooper, wandered into the office with 8x10 glossy picks of the band and copies of their first two albums, Easy Action and Pretty's for You. And he said, "What this band needs is that Guess Who sound. We want Jack Richardson as our producer." And honestly, Jack was very polite, because we're Canadians. We're very polite. And
that's right.
Yes. If you want to get 200 Canadians out of your pool, just say, "Please get out of the pool." And anyway, so Jack would never say no outright to anybody. He just said, "This is very interesting. You know, that's quite unique." He'd never seen anything like these guys, nor had I, none of us had, but I mean, they, you know, they were like a clown car, you know, but a rock band. And, you know, they were, Alice was wearing a ballet tutu and spider eyes makeup, and the other guys, they had braided mutton chops and painted fingernails, and it just, you'd never seen anything quite like that before. So Jack really didn't feel it. And my job was to basically get rid of him. So, and you know, he said, "Well, you know, this is very interesting. You know, I'll have the kid go and see the band. And if the kid likes the band, then perhaps I'll go and see the band as well, and we'll see, you know. And if I like it, then sure, you know, it'd be great to do," and all that stuff. Shep walked out thinking he had a deal, and everybody in the office after he left were kind of like, "This ain't gonna happen, you know. We're not doing this. Yeah, this is not our thing." So they sent me to New York on September 8th, 1970. To go see Alice Cooper play the midnight show at Max's Kansas City. And I went with a friend who was playing, at the time he was playing Burger in Hair, which was the most cutting edge, you know, piece of popular culture at the time, because there was full frontal nudity, right? And And so he's playing, and he's another Canadian CBC baby like me. And we actually met at Hare, and then he came down to see the show with me. We walk in there, and it's like stepping into a Hieronymus Bosch painting. Everybody had spider eyes and spandex and big high heels, and they were all wraith white, and had jet black hair and jet black fingernails. And they fairly floated across the floor. You know, their feet never touched the ground, and it was like, okay, this is the zombie apocalypse, and we're in it right now. And we're these two hippies from Canada, you know. So anyway, they give us a table at the front of the stage. The show goes on, and it is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. It's just, it's Dada-esque. It's, you know, it's rock theater. It's the theater of the absurd for sure. And but it's also got a heavy, heavy beat, and everybody in the audience knows all the words to songs that haven't even been released yet. So
yeah, wow.
Yeah, wow. So when it was over, I looked at Alan and I just went, what was that? He said, I don't know, but I think I liked it. And I said, well, I think I fucking loved it. And and so I went running up the stairs and just said, we'll do it. We'll, you know, I think you guys can make hit records and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I had to go back and fight for my job after that, you know.
Well, so how did you sell it to
I sold it to Jack. I went in the office, and honestly, I just said, look, this isn't rock and roll. There were no T-shirts. There were no jeans. They had spider eyes and spandex, and everybody was jet black hair and black fingernails, and they had, you know, props and sets and lights. And I said, Jack, this isn't rock and roll music. It's the beginning of a cultural movement. And wow. Jack's like, okay, enough already. You know, if you like it so much, you do it. And he said, and I'll back you up.
Wow. So you handled the sessions primarily.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, they sent me to Pontiac, Michigan to work with Alice Cooper right away. I mean, so that was September 8th. I would say it was within the next month that I started heading down to Pontiac. And I was doing pre-production because that's what I was good at. And to me, to this day, pre-production is the most important part of the process for me. But, I was working with them on the material. We were reorganizing the songs. The first song we did was Is It My Body? Which we completely deconstructed and then reconstructed so that everybody's actually listening to each other. And I mean, they were all playing lead all the time. There was lead drums, lead bass, lead guitars, lead vocals, you know, and it was a mess. It was really a mess. So we had to divide it into, you know, rhythm section, melody and counter melody, which is basically the basic rock structure. So, and I started doing that with them. And Alice to this day says, well, I have no idea why we listen to you. I said, I don't either. But thank God, you know, it worked out. So first song we did was Is It My Body? The second song we did was I'm 18. And after that, after putting those two songs together in their big barn, we had a love-in, you know, where... everybody did illegal substances and we all got to, I love you, man. I love you, man. No, you're the greatest. No, you are. You're fantastic. And we all agreed that this was going to work. So we kept going. And then Jack joined us in the studio in Chicago for the first recording session. Warner Brothers at that time was saying, like, Bob, who? Like, who is this guy? And Jack says, no, he's with me. And I'm there. Don't you worry. And so he made that whole thing possible. Then we got into the studio in Chicago, and he kicked me in the ass and pushed me forward to the console.
Right. But it wasn't like he was dropping you in the deep end, because you've been swimming. I mean, you've been practicing all along. You know what I mean?
So, well,
you needed the kick in the ass, I'm sure, just to take the dive. But once you were in the water.
I had been doing... Yes. Okay. Yes. I'd been doing stuff like that, sort of similar, but this was a, like, this is a, an album for Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
For the Warner Brothers that had all these artists on it that I was just, you know, in awe of. And they were, and, you know, and the bosses at Warner Brothers were in Hollywood. You know, this was big for a kid from Toronto. Anyway, and, you know, and we're in the studio in Chicago, and that's a whole other animal and stuff. We had a fantastic engineer named Brian Christian, who lives out here in just east of LA. And, anyway, you know, the sessions went really well. Within those first, the Warner Brothers said, yes, sorry. Warner Brothers said, Bob, who? So they said, you're only doing four songs. That's it. And we'll have a look. So we did four songs, and they included Is It My Body and I'm 18 and Black Juju and You Drive Me Nervous. So we recorded those four songs. They went back to Warner Brothers, and everybody was thrilled.
Okay.
And so we got to do the rest of the album, which we did very quickly. I think our total time on recording that album was 2 weeks in the studio and 18 hours mixing.
Wow, yeah. So that's the value of pre-production too then, you know. I mean, you were in there too. You knew what you were going to do, and you got to work to do it.
Yeah, and that's also the value of not, you know, spending inordinate amounts of time worrying about details. You know, we're just getting it down. And you're right. We knew what to do. We knew what to play. That was the big thing. We came in prepared. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you. So that's Love It to Death. Then next is Killer, School's Out, Billion Dollar Babies. Is there any one of those that is the quintessential Alice Cooper album? I mean, you know, we love all our children, but do you have a favorite out of those?
That's a good question. I think I have a favorite only in terms of, you know, what it meant to me from a development point of view. I think my big turning point was School's Out, where, you know, I had experimented with adding orchestral elements and things like that and sound effects and so on. But I, you know, School's Out was where I really got to use the studio as an instrument, you know, in a big way for the first time. And I credit that in large measure to having moved to New York and working at the record plant in New York, which was just like a cauldron of creativity, amazing people all around that building. But in particular, Roy Sakala, who was the chief engineer and co-owner of the place. He was just a remarkable engineer and creative force. And he had a bad but really good habit for me of about 6 o'clock every night saying, I'm just going to the bathroom. I'll see you in a minute. And he'd leave. He'd just leave. He'd leave the building and go home.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you'd be left on your own, you know. And which was, for me, was fantastic because I got to sit down and push the faders and turn the knobs and do stuff and try things. It was, yeah. So for me, that's the big breakthrough, and that would be my favorite on that basis. On the basis of what the quintessential Alice Cooper album is, I mean, everybody's got their favorite, but probably Billion Dollar Babies, I would say.
You know, you continue to work with Vincent Fournier, lead singer Alice Cooper, and over subsequent albums, beginning with 1975's Welcome to My Nightmare. Is there anything markedly different going forward after, you know, you're working, the band has sort of ended, but he's taking on the name. Did anything change with your all's relationship? Or how did the relationship change now? Now it's not
with whose relationship? Which one?
Your relationship with Vincent,
with Alice
Cooper.
Yeah. Well, first of all, he changed his name to Alice Cooper, so he didn't get the name. He was the name. And that came from Pat Kingsley, the, you know, legendary PR genius, who Shep enlisted to help with the band. And she said, well, I don't know how to sell a band called Alice Cooper when there's no one named Alice Cooper in the band. And, you know, this was back in the days where we were a little more literal than we are now. And so the boys all got together and they just said, well, like, who's going to do that? And then they all figured, you know, Vince talks better than most of us. So let's let him be Alice Cooper. So he became Alice Cooper. And then after a certain time, he changed his name legally to Alice Cooper. And when the band broke up, that's not even the right term. When the band decided to go into individual directions temporarily, Shep said, don't do this, because if you want to do solo albums and things like that, he's going to do a solo album. And I'm telling you, the results will not be good. But everybody was sort of hell-bent on doing other things. And I had, you know, I left after Billion Dollar Babies. I started Muscle of Love, but by that time, the band had kind of decided that I was too controlling that, you know, Alice and I were too much the focus, and, you know, that they really had lots to say and they wanted more of a voice and all that stuff. So they were really resistant. We went into pre-production and I would do my usual thing, you know, well, wait a minute, stop, hang on for a second, just play that last 8 bars. And then they'd say, no, we don't want to do that. We really like them the way they are. So, you know, we really don't want to do that. And, you know, after about an hour and a half of just being completely stonewalled, I took Alice for a walk around the block. This was in Toronto, as a matter of fact. And I took Alice for a walk around the block and just said, listen, you know, they don't want to work with me. And that's very clear to me right now. And I'm tired, and I don't really want to fight, so I'm out. But if you ever decide to do anything on your own, call me. I'll be there. So that was it. That was, you know, they went off and did, and I did say to him, and I'll get you somebody to do this record, you know. So I got Jack Richardson, my mentor and boss, you know, a better producer than I'll ever be, and Jack Douglas, who was my protege, you know, was somebody that I had been training and mentoring. And I put the two Jacks together. I figured that would be amazing. They were going to do a great job. So they did Muscle of Love. And after that, then the band started talking about the solo projects and all that stuff. And that's when Shep said, please don't do this. But they did. And Alice went off and they decided to do a big, big, big project, which is what Welcome to My Nightmare was, you know, a big show with lots of effects and all that sort of stuff. And they called me, which I'm very glad they did, because I really loved working on that record and all of the subsequent records with Alice. Alice and I have been working together for 55 years.
Wow, I know. I mean, yeah.
That's pretty fair innings, I would say.
Right. That's the length of your career, really.
I mean, it is. It's Alice the length of my entire career. He's the beginning, and he may be the end.
Well, I want to speak. Go back to you. You recently. It's the Revenge of Alice Cooper. But when Billion Dollar Babies was coming out, that's like 73, and that's when I believe that's when Lou Reed's Berlin came out. How did you wind up working with Lou Reed?
I had done a record with Mitch Ryder and his band Detroit, where we covered rock and roll, Lou Reed's rock and roll.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's great.
He loved that cover so much that after Transformer, which, by the way, even though Transformer begat the biggest pop hit that Lou ever had, Walk on the Wild Side, he hated it. He was not happy.
He hated Walk on the Wild Side. He hated, right?
Yeah, he didn't even like the whole album. Yeah. But he really didn't like Walk on the Wild Side, and he didn't like it because it became pop. And because in his head, he was not that. He was Charles Bukowski more than he was Mick Jagger. And So he wanted something else, and he really loved our very raw version of rock and roll, and he said, you know, like, get me that guy. So I went to see him at, which is, this is a funny story, but I went to see him play Massey Hall in Toronto, and the opening act was Genesis.
Okay.
So I went, and they'd been playing Genesis on Chum FM, our sort of alternative FMer in Toronto, and I'd been listening to it and just been, you know, fascinated with the music and the you know, it just was another creature. It was something that you had not heard before. So I wanted to see them. I went early so I could see the opening act. And when Gabriel came up through the trap door with a flower on his head, I just turned to Lou's manager, which was probably not the right thing to do, but I said, you know, can you get me the kid with the flower on his head? You know, can I work with that person? And, you know, but anyway, so we went, and then Lou came out. Lou was the epitome of dangerous. It was amazing. I loved it. He defied the audience in a certain way, you know, and he dared the audience with some of his lyrics and some, and just the way he looked and the way he sounded and the way he beat on his guitar. He beat it up when he was playing. So I just loved it. And after the show, he came over to my house and we sat on the floor. And he had an acoustic guitar and he started to play me some stuff, which was okay. I mean, it was Lou Reed. So, I mean, you know, it's brilliant, yeah. but it didn't do for me what I had seen on that stage. And also it didn't seem to be a progression from where he was. And I, you know, I said, this is really good stuff, but I said, you know, you tend to tell a life in 2 minutes and 30 seconds. And sometimes I'm so into it that I really want to know more. Like, you know, what's the full story, you know? And I said, for example, you know, in that song you wrote called Berlin, you're talking about this couple and where they go and like, well, what happened? You know, where does it go from here? And who were they? And, you know, why can't we tell something like that? Why can't we do a story like the one from Berlin, but in longer form? So basically I was talking about a concept record before I knew what concept records were. But, you know, and then I had a V8 moment.
Let me ask this question here. So you give him that idea, and was he initially receptive to that, or was he?
He was like, you know, he sat back and he was listening. Lou's super smart and super observant of everything, as you can tell, and you know, in the music that he writes and the lyrics that he writes. So he, you know, that sort of knocked him back a little bit. He just sat back and I could hear the wheels turning, you know. It was obviously an interesting subject to him. But what happened next was like, I you know, I'm saying we should do something like Berlin. And then I went, wait a minute, if that's your song, why don't we take that and tell the rest of the story? That's when he went, oh my God, that's a great idea. So he said, you know, give me a month or something like that. Give me 6 weeks. And 6 weeks later, he came back and he played me Caroline Says. And okay. I just fell off my chair, you know, and Oh Jim and stuff like that. And I was like, I was so happy and so impressed with what he had done in such a short period of time. And so then I, you know, I had the songs and I recorded them all on my little tape thingy. And then I said, well, give me a month. And then we'll go record it. So, and then I spent the rest of that time imagining the record and then turning the imagination, those imaginings, into arrangements which were done before we got to London. So including like the orchestral stuff, all that orchestral stuff was done before we went to London to record the basic tracks. And then we put together a band, an amazing band of misfits, and we cut these, you know, we cut these tracks sort of a little bit to spec because there was these orchestrations that were already organized, you know, that I couldn't really move around very much. So we had to stay within that roadmap. And the band was incredibly receptive to that, to working that way. Right. It was a new way for all of us to work, but it was really good. And that was, I think for me, that was my turning point in terms of my ability to imagine the outcome of the project before getting into it. And which I can't explain that to anybody, but you know, if it is very much like anybody who's about to make something, if you're about to build a house, you don't just get a bunch of wood, nails, and stand there and just start whacking away. You know, you need to have, you got to have a blueprint, a plan. And only in, you know, some of the performing arts do people actually go start building the house before they know what the house is going to look like. And and that's never been, for me, I've never been completely comfortable doing that. I really prefer to have, you know, engineer's drawings, if you will. You know, I really prefer to know what I'm going for and then go for it.
Let me ask you here about Kiss, because there are a couple of similarities with Alice Cooper. I mean, theatrics. Another thing seems to be pre-production stuff. You were working with Alice and putting them kind of through their paces there. That seems like there's some stories with Kiss talking about working with you. And I want to know if this is true. Were you wearing a whistle around your neck? And would you like blow the whistle and yes. tell them things like, campers, we're going to go to work?
Yes.
Those guys are
for
Destroyer, huh?
Yes. Right? Well, you know, listen. The Kiss guys were a riot. First of all, every one of them was funny in their own way, and so basically they were chaotic is a good way to put it. You know, the band was kind of chaotic, even though what they did was with an incredible purpose and very well thought through. They, you know, they weren't winging it when they got to stage. They were incredibly well rehearsed and practiced, and they knew exactly what it was they were going to do. But in the studio, my God, to get everybody to pay attention, and they're all big personalities, and nobody wants to listen to anyone. You know, so either I had to shout, which I was doing for a few days, and then I got sick and tired of shouting to get people's attention, just to get people to, you know, stop goofing around. We got to make a record here, you know. So I went out and I knew the one thing that people of my generation all respond to is the camp counselor's whistle. We all went to camp, right? So I went and got a whistle. And I went in and I blew it one time. I went, campers, and there was silence. And I thought, this is genius. It works, right? There was silence. They just looked at me. I said, okay, we're going to work. And they would go, okay, you know. So it was Pavlovian. But it worked. It worked really well.
Well, let me touch on two things quickly, because this is so interesting, because the Alice Cooper guys are saying, oh, you're too controlling, but... I mean, you're trying to get him to a point where, you know, you're working on the songs, improving the songs. And there's also this sort of boot camp musicianship with Kiss. So I'm just opposed to that. Seems to be what I've read about you working with Roger Waters and Pink Floyd's The Wall, where, so let me know if this is true, that at the outset, he's what I've read is that he makes it clear to you that he's the guy in charge. And the quote is, you can write anything you want, just don't expect any credit. And it just seems like that's a very different type of personality to be working with compared to you know, the Cooper guys or the Kiss.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the art of being a producer, I guess, to dealing with, you know, all types.
I think in life, one of the most important things in life for children in particular is that they have to... have to be allowed to play, and to play in groups without adult supervision. And in that process, they learn how to deal with each other. They learn how to resolve conflict. They learn, you know, that certain kids are different from other kids. They learn how to socialize, all that sort of stuff. I had a lot of that as a kid. And I was sort of one of, you know, I was kind of the group leader on our street. And there was a ton of us, a ton. We ran free. So I dealt with kids who were all of different shapes and sizes and different religions, different colors, different everything. And we all found a way to understand each other and to get along. So when you get to the studio and you have that kind of, you know, you have that upbringing and exposure, it's a lot easier to deal with the various different personalities, and particularly when you're dealing with creative people whose personalities tend to be slightly exaggerated in comparison to most people. So, that was it. That, yes, I had to deal with all kinds of different people, but I was already set up for that. Being the eldest of eight, and also being the kid leader on my block, you know, right? So, with Roger and the whole the initial meetings and the whole sort of setup to going into the wall, you know, they had been running their own show for a long time. He felt that he was underappreciated and that not being given enough credit for being the driving force within the band, in his opinion. And he'd already written these two projects. One became The Pros and Cons, and the other one was The Wall. He'd written them, he demoed them. They weren't complete, but they were pretty detailed demos. So he played both for me and asked me which one I thought Pink Floyd ought to do. And I picked The Wall, of course. And so did all the members of the band, because he did the same thing with them. He played them the two things. Okay. They picked The Wall. But it was not. It was like 90 minutes of da 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 da. And I'm like, you know, this is really cool. And it was really cool, and the lyrics were amazing. I said, this is really cool, but I think we need, you know, to change it up from time to time, and we need to have different kinds of songs in there. And I'm happy to help with that. And that's when he said what he said. He really was, in his mind, his project. And in fact, I think he would have been happier calling it Pink Floyd but having it be a solo record. And of course, that wouldn't be Pink Floyd, and it wouldn't have worked. So a large part of my job was to bring the other guys in a more prominent and productive way than he had maybe imagined.
Make it more like a band, right?
Make the band
be the band.
And also, you know, you can't take David Gilmour out of Pink Floyd. You just can't. And you can't. I mean, actually, the truth is, you can't take any of them out of Pink Floyd.
Right.
Rick Wright, you know, was so important. That voice, then his keyboard parts, and all that stuff, and his spirit, you know. And Nick Mason, there is nobody that drums like Nick Mason. He may not be the world's greatest drummer, but he is the perfect drummer for Pink Floyd.
Right.
And yeah. So anyway, that's what happened. So there was a lot of push-pull. There was a lot of head-beating and stuff. And Roger does tend to be a bit of a bully. And so, you know, and I don't like bullies. So we did go head-to-head. But at the same time, he was also absolutely brilliant, had an amazing, crazy kind of sense of humor. And on one hand, I loved him. You know, I really did. But then we had a terrible falling out at the end of the project.
Over the course of your career, there's been so much change, the way records are made, and also just the music, the business side of the music business. Are there any good things that have happened in the music industry since the 70s when you started? And then what are the bad things? What are the good things the good things that happened.
I think that the technology and new tools that have been introduced all through the process of from when recording started until till today, I think it's been a really good thing on many levels. And I just sum it up, it's like it's one sentence. It's basically the good news is now, because of the democratization of the tools, everybody can get their hands on the same tools now. It used to be a much more exclusive thing. So the good news now is that anybody can make a record. And the bad news is that anybody can make a record. So,
it comes close to that adage about the world has too many lawyers, but it could always use one more good one.
Yeah.
You know, meaning that everyone has access and too many people have access. But if it's somebody that's really got the talent, they're going to have more abilities to make a record or have access.
That's it.
To the tool.
I mean, that's it. You're exactly right. That is it. You know, that with everybody having access to all of these tools now and being able to do this without having to have hundreds of thousands of dollars behind them, suddenly new and exciting things are happening and coming out of people's basements and bedrooms and out of groups that may never ever have surfaced before, but also now we're flooded with just a tsunami of mediocrity. I am concerned about how AI is going to be used now going forward. Although I love it, I'm an early adopter. I understand it. I fear it as well, because if you understand it,
what have you used AI for?
I've used AI more outside of my music work. More for some of the other stuff that I do, but within music, I've used Suno and I've used it as a kind of demoing tool for me. You know, as I said before, I like to have a floor plan before I start to build. So with this, I can try out ideas for songs and I can just have it orchestrated for me, like right there. And it's fast and easy. So that's kind of cool. But what I don't like is when people just talk a record into, just type in prompts and make their record that way, where they don't actually do any of the performance themselves, even the performance of, mixing or producing or any of that stuff. They just imagine, type it, and the software spits it out. And I only don't like that because what I've heard so far of the stuff that's been spit out has been, it's been safe, it's been overly perfect, and it's been too referential and kind of repetitive, in a way. It's just taken things that worked before and made them, and incorporated them into the new thing. So I worry that what it's going to do is stifle innovation, that people won't stumble on new stuff because they're not going to get their hands dirty. Anyway, I could be wrong about that, and this could be the beginning of a golden age of all kinds of new stuff. In this case, I'm not sure. With everything else that I've seen happen from multi-track recording to digital to all steps along the way, I've thought, okay, this is going to open up amazing possibilities. This one opens up amazing possibilities that may not in the end be good.
Is there any artist that's caught your ear recently that you would really love to work with if you had the opportunity to? Someone that's not well known?
Oh, wow. Someone that's not well known. That's a good question. I'd have to really think about that. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of ones that are really well known that I would love to work with. Well, you know, Chapel Roan, for example, you know, I just think she's awesome. And I love her point of view. I really think it's amazing. But I mean, in terms of like, things that I've heard that I really like, you know, there's the Gabriels.
Okay.
That I really like. There's kind of I don't know. You know, that's a tough one. You're really, you know, yeah, Emily Nicholas. Do you know who Emily Nicholas is?
No, I do not.
Yeah,
shine a light for me. Who is Emily Nicholas?
Well, I don't really know who she is. I just know some of her music, you know, and I heard her version of Higher Love, and I just thought, wow, you know, that's really quite remarkable. That kind of stuff. Anyway, you know, as things come up, I pay attention. I do like some of what's come out of the Demon Hunters, the K-pop Demon Hunters, like some of the stuff that came out of that. On that soundtrack, I thought was really inventive and smart and great.
We're going to go out with a Hanoi Rocks tune, and you produced the fifth album, 1984's Two Steps from the Move. I'm understanding they were really thrilled to be working with you. What do you recall about those guys, Hanoi Rocks?
Well, I recall an awful lot of things about those guys. That, you know, talk about a complicated group of characters, you know. But they
were
fat.
That's your forte. I guess
it is. You know that if you've got a box of cats, you know, throw me in there and I'll. But you know they came from Finland, which
right
at the time didn't make it to the happiest country list ever. You know that at the time it was bleak and. That, you know, there weren't a lot of opportunities and these kids were misfits and lovers of what they were hearing from coming out of England in particular, but coming out of England and the United States, they had rock and roll dreams. That was it. You know, as they were growing up, they heard things and saw things that they wanted to do and be. And so they became the characters that, you know, came together as Hanoi Rocks, you know, so, you know, they all took on new names, you know, Nasty Suicide and, you know, and Michael Monroe and they took on personas, which was, you know, very interesting that they developed personas that were so multidimensional that by the time I met them, you know, they were those people. They weren't playing people. They were those people. And they just, you know, they were a really tough sounding, amazing to look at. Interesting rock band. I went to see them in Leeds, which is in the north of England. I went to see a live show at the University of Leeds, and that's what convinced me that I wanted to do the band because they were just so dangerous on stage. I use that word again, but you know, very much like Lou, they were bending so many things. They were gender bending. They were, you know, they were. Taking styles and twisting them around and so on. But anyway, so I saw them live.
Did you have to put them through a boot camp? Did you have to do like a boot camp with these guys as well?
No, I didn't have to do. No, there wasn't a boot camp per se, but we did do a lot of pre-production. So we worked in London on the pre-production for the album. And just injecting some discipline into it because they were very loose, very loosey-goosey. And so, you know, when I say injecting some discipline, I mean into the parts, you know, into the parts that people were playing, to be really, like, super careful about how the bass and drums fit together and how the role that the rhythm guitars were playing just to make it so that this, it was like this, you know, tank of a rhythm section that was rolling on steel treads, you know, towards you kind of thing. That was the idea. And working with Michael a lot on lyrics and also on his accent to make sure that it wasn't, you know, that we could disguise it as much as possible, because that's what they wanted to be. They wanted to be an English rock band. So that was great. And I loved Razzle. I literally loved him. I just thought he was the sweetest, funniest, in a certain way also, you know, in a certain way, sort of pathetic, because he was a bit lost, and he glommed on to things that weren't necessarily good for him, and some people that weren't necessarily good for him, including the one who ended up killing him. When Razzle died, it literally broke my heart, and it broke the band. I remember exactly where I was. I remember getting the phone call. I remember exactly how I felt. I couldn't work for weeks after hearing that. But anyway, yeah, it's one of those terrible, you know, I guess we all experience it at some point or another when we're in that big, bad business of rock and roll. But losing somebody like that, and under those circumstances, somebody that was so sweet and that you cared for so much, that was an incredibly traumatic experience for me. On the other hand, the making of the album was fun and full of rock power. It was great as I was hearing it come out of the speakers, you know, the things that we had built in the rehearsal studio to hear them really, to hear them being realized like that. Standing in the control room and listening, sometimes I was just so proud of them, so proud.
Yeah. Man, Bob, thank you so much for speaking with me today on Our Coolest Conversations. It's been such an honor to pick your brain about your career and experiences.
Well, thanks. I'm sorry to be so long-winded about all this stuff. But,
no, you know, there's a lot of stuff to talk about. I mean, clearly is. we keep going. But yes, we'll go out now with a track from Hanoi Rocks off of Two Steps from the Move. This is Don't You Ever Leave Me, Hanoi Rocks, in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Wearing me down, and it's hard getting through the day, 'cause I need you right now, and right now you're so far away. I guess that I should have known that I'd end up this way, but I swear I'll come home.
That's Hanoi Rocks here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with a cut, Don't You Ever Leave Me. That's off their fifth album, 1984's Two Steps from the Move. Recording produced by Bob Ezrin. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Bob for making this Coolest Conversation so special. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. UK Medway band The Limp Price 3 are faves of ours here in the Underground Garage, and their latest album, Misty Medway Magic, is out now on Wicked Cool Records. I'm going to find out all about it next time around when I'm joined by the band's lead singer and lead guitarist, Glenn Page. He's my guest for our next Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Driving into the darkness, I jump inside, 'cause I ain't got nowhere to sleep tonight. Don't you ever leave me, baby.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.